Oh, this one? Okay. All right. Thank you, Darrell. Pleasure to be here this afternoon to visit with you about this little task that we had down in Atlanta. Do you want to acknowledge Mary Ellen for their support in helping us to get together to talk about this topic? Also, Merlin, I want to acknowledge him. Did a really nice job of trying to summarize, you know, that two-day conference we had. That would be a huge task to try to undertake. Did a nice job on that. Well, so we're going to get going here and look at this idea of, can we use serum IGF-1 as a predictor of RFI? Okay. Merlin's already done a nice job to lay out some background, but I thought I would actually show you a little bit of data as well so you can better comprehend the kind of variation in intake that we're talking about. This first slide just reiterates what Merlin's already said. RFI is simply another way to express efficiency, and it attempts to look at the variation in intake that is separate from maintenance and growth energy requirements. The key thing to remember about RFI is that it's independent of growth. In other words, we can select for improved RFI, cattle eat less than expected, and we should not impact the mature weight of the cow herd. In contrast to that, if we were to select for improved feed-to-gain ratio, we would indirectly be selecting for increased growth, and along with that, then, we'd have larger mature cow sizes. So the key thing about RFI to remember, the key advantage as a trait, is it's independent of average yearly gain growth genetics of the cow herd. It is moderately heritable, as Merlin was explaining. And genetic improvement in RFI, if we elect to use that as part of a multi-trait selection index, is going to be beneficial not only for the feedlot sector, but also for the cow herd as well. How is it measured? Merlin, again, has already covered this nicely, so we don't really need to go into that. Let me just shift to the next graph here. This is some data from one of our first efficiency tests that we did in collaboration with a commercial bull test facility south of College Station. And if I recall right, there was about 140 bulls in this particular test, and they were Angus, predominantly Angus bulls with a few Brangus cattle in there. What I've done here is I've plotted the intake of all those cattle against average yearly gain, and you can see that the red dots represent all the individual animals. And the first thing, you know, if you're not used to seeing this kind of data, that ought to really stand out to you is that there's a lot of variation. When you look at the variation from 26 pounds down to 14 pounds, there's also a lot of variation in gain. You've got slow gaining bulls and fast gaining bulls. That black line that goes through that is the best fit line, and that's from that multiple linear regression model that Merlin was describing. Think of that black line as being the expected intake. And that black line goes up as average yearly gain of the cattle goes up. It just says that cattle that are gaining 5 pounds a day are going to eat more than cattle that gain 2 pounds per day. Because if cattle are gaining 5 pounds per day, they have a higher energy requirement. So that black line is the best fit line. That's the average response in terms of intake by a group of animals as average yearly gain goes up. But what you really need to know now next is look at that variation of those red dots around that black predicted line. And that's what we're interested in. That's that residual portion that we're trying to measure and then try to use that residual portion to select for efficient or inefficient cattle. And I've identified two bulls here. And the reason I picked out those two bulls is that they're kind of in the middle of the pack. They both gained about the same and their body weights were about the same. But they had differences in intake, one above that line and one below that line. Now this next graph, what we're looking at here is the feed-to-gain ratio, the traditional feed efficiency trait that we're used to thinking about. And the thing to note here is, again, this is the same set of cattle. The x-axis, the gain is the same. What's different is we're plotting all the individual bulls' feed-to-gain ratio against gain. First thing to note is that that slope of that line is going down and to the right, meaning there's a negative relationship between feed-to-gain ratio and average yearly gain. It just says that those animals that gain the most are typically going to have the lowest B-to-gain ratio. And that's good, obviously, okay, but it's not good from a perspective of trying to select cattle. Now, if we were to set up a bull test, select for feed-to-gain ratio, and then use all these bulls, lower part of that graph, in our selection program, what we're going to be doing is indirectly selecting for increased growth. And with that, then, of course, will be increased calf size. And so the key thing to note here is that there's a big relationship, strong relationship, between feed-to-gain ratio and average yearly gain. Now, finally, this last graph, again, the same animals, but here what we're plotting is the individual data, residual feed intake against gain. And recall we said that residual feed intake is independent of average yearly gain. And so the best fit line that goes through this data is right there. It's flat. There's a zero correlation. And a lot of folks in Australia and folks like Denny Cruz have looked at that genetically. In addition to gain being phenotypically independent of RFI, it is also, in most cases, genetically independent. And so we have then a lot of variation in residual feed intake, okay, that's independent of average yearly gain. Now keep in mind that if an animal's up here above this zero line, that's positive residual feed intake. The animal's eating more than it should based on its body weight and gain. We want those animals that are below that line, those animals that are eating less than expected for their body weight and gain. The other thing to note is that we have a lot of variation on both sides of average growth rate and above average growth rate. So in other words, we've got bulls that are very efficient below this line that are also fast gainers. We have an equal number of bulls on the left side that are efficient in terms of RFI, but also are slow gainers. Okay. Again, these two blue dots here represent those two animals. Okay. The actual intake of that top animal, 20 pounds. That bottom animal, 16 pounds. Notice that their expected intake is the same. Okay. Remember that residual feed intake is actual intake minus expected intake. Expected intake is based on body weight and gain. Since those two bulls weigh the same, or are close to be the same, and gain close to be the same, that's why expected intake is the same. And so residual feed intake is a +2 for the top bull, a -2 for the bottom bull. So again, just kind of go through and explain a little bit more what this residual feed intake is all about. Okay, Merlin brought up a good point. You know, residual feed intake is certainly good from an efficiency perspective to consider in multi-trait selection indices, but our challenge is that measuring feed intake is expensive. And of course, if we go out and we start to say, let's really focus on measuring intake and computing something like RFI, what are we going to do? Where are most of you guys going to go to try to find those facilities? Right now, we have limited infrastructure for people to consider taking bulls to measure feed intake. That's a big, big challenge for us right now. Also, there's always concerns about co-mingling cattle. You know, you bring cattle together from multiple sources, you're more likely to get disease outbreak, et cetera. So that brings up the obvious point. You know, would be nice if we could find an indicator trait that would help us to make selections for RFI earlier in the lifespan of that bull. That would also help us to improve the accuracy prediction of genetic merit for RFI. And so are those kind of traits, indicator traits, out there? And so that's what we're trying to search for. This is just a little schematic to try to explain, you know, the concept of a two-stage selection process, where if we did have good genetic markers, you know, and hopefully we're going to have some pretty soon, and if we had things like EPDs for RFI, if we had other physiological markers, we could measure those indicator traits early in a calf or bull's life, have that information back, make decisions based on those indicator traits, genetic markers, also consider the other traits of interest on that particular individual, and then make the decision then, should we take that bull and submit it to a central bull test to measure actual feed intake and actual RFI, or not? Okay? And so that's the concept behind a two-stage selection process, where if we have good indicator traits, we could be benefiting from that. Now, don't want to spend a lot of time on this graph, but I do want to try to emphasize that this RFI concept is real. And what I've done here is list some research findings relative to some traits that are very much associated with efficient utilization of feed in animals. Things like heat production, which is tied to maintenance energy requirements. Things like digestibility of feed. Physical activity associated with maintenance energy requirements. All these things are very important. The variation that we see in animals in terms of efficiency, if it is linked to one of these biological traits like maintenance requirement or physical activity, it would help us then to sort out more in the future what possible physiological indicator traits there might be. Also, we can begin to consider searching for genes of interest that are linked to things like heat production, linked to things like digestibility. What this is showing is there's two columns of numbers there. Those are phenotypic correlations from research projects where people have looked at the variation in residual feed intake and the variation in heat production, the top two rows, variation in methane production, variation in dry matter digestibility of feed, and then variation in feeding behavior traits that Merlin was talking about. A positive correlation up on these top two rows here, 0.68, 0.56, tells us that those animals with low RFI will also have lower heat production relative to animals with high RFI. When they looked at the same variation in heat production and looked at it in terms of feed conversion ratio, in the first experiment there was in fact also a positive correlation between heat production and feed gain ratio. It just wasn't as strong as it was with RFI. In the second experiment, they didn't report it. Okay, methane production, also what they found here is that it was not correlated, methane, with feed gain ratio. Dry matter digestibility, we found a negative correlation between RFI and dry matter digestibility. What this says, again, animals that have a lower RFI actually have a little bit higher dry matter digestibility. Now, it accounts for very little of the variation, but it's going in the right direction to help us explain why there is this variation in a contemporary group of animals. Lastly, we're finding also that there's a relationship between feeding behavior traits. The technology we have now available, companies like GrowSafe, and there's other outfits out there, where we can electronically measure intake, but also we can electronically measure feeding behavior traits. And I know Merlin at Nebraska has done work with sheep and has found a genetic correlation between feeding behavior and efficiency in sheep. I've not seen that same data yet in cattle. What this is looking at is some of the data we've acquired looking at the phenotypic relationships between feeding behavior traits and RFI. Again, just to give you a perspective of where some of these indicator traits may go in terms of helping us predict RFI genetic merit cattle. What I'm trying to show you here are phenotypic correlations. There's three feeding behavior traits. The one on the left there is feeding duration, also sometimes called bunk visit duration. That's how many minutes does an individual animal spend at the feed bunk per day. The second parameter there, meal frequency, is how many meals per day did the animal go up to consume, 24-hour rate. Last one here is eating rate. Eating rate is simply the intake of the animal divided by feeding duration. Did they eat their feed fast or slow when they went to the feed bunk? Now, the first two sets of bars here, the red one is looking at the variation in gain, the blue one, variation in intake. And essentially what we found is that feeding duration and meal frequency were not very highly correlated or related to, you know, the feeding duration and meal frequency. So cattle that ate a lot or ate very little or gained fast or gained slow, there wasn't much variation in feeding duration or meal frequency. Okay? But as you can see in the right-hand side of that graph, there was variation in eating rate. Now, positive correlations tell us then that those animals that gain the fastest, ate the most feed per day, were those animals that were eating at a faster rate when they went up to the feed bunk. Okay. Now, we looked at the correlations with feed-to-gain ratio. There was no significance. So we couldn't explain any of the variation in feed-to-gain ratio within a contemporary group of animals. And here we had about 240 animals that could be explained by variation in feeding behavior traits. But if we looked at residual feed intake, we see that there's a pretty moderate size correlation, positive, between feeding duration and RFI. Again, saying that those animals that are negative in RFI, low, tend to eat, feed or spend about 20 minutes per day less at the bunk than cattle that have high RFI. Meal frequency was lowly correlated there, not very strong. And then if you look at eating rate did not explain any of the variation in RFI. So this is just an example of an indicator trait that may prove to be useful down the road. So that's all a preview to get into the topic at hand, which is, should we consider insulin-like growth factor as a physiological indicator trait for RFI? A little bit of background. I don't want to spend too much time here, but IGF-1, as we refer to it as, is a naturally occurring protein secreted by all mammals, and it's secreted primarily by the liver tissue. We refer to it as an anabolic hormone because it's very much involved in terms of driving growth of bone, muscle, and adipose tissue. There's a lot of specific biological actions that it undertakes. The key ones are that IGF-1 that's circulating in our bodies, in our bloodstreams, is involved in terms of transporting amino acids and helping utilization of amino acids by muscle tissue to synthesize protein. IGF-1 is also involved in helping to transport glucose from the blood into adipocytes and helping to stimulate lipolysis or fat tissue growth. Also involved in mineralization of bone. So IGF-1 is involved in a lot of processes. It really does serve as one of the key regulatory hormones between nutrient utilization and growth of tissue. This diagram here is pretty scary, but I just want to try to emphasize that the endocrine system involving the regulation of growth is very complicated. And there's more than just what's on this graph here, but it starts at the starts at the hypothalamus. We have a signal for increased release of growth hormone releasing factor, which then releases growth hormone from the pituitary. This growth hormone molecule here is a protein type molecule. That's actually the product that Monsanto makes and injects and markets for dairy cows to increase milk production. But that growth hormone, when it's released from the pituitary, will go to lots of tissues in the body, primarily the liver, and it will then stimulate the release of this IGF-1 molecule. And then this IGF-1 molecule then is involved, as I said before, with stimulation of growth processes in our major tissues of interest. Now, that IGF-1 that we have circulating in our blood, in cattle's blood, is influenced by lots of things. I've just listed four here. High grain diets versus forage fed diets. If we have forage fed animals, we measure their IGF-1, put them on high grain for 30 days, you're going to see a noticeable increase in serum IGF levels. I mean, it's 30-40% increase because they're on a high grain diet. Okay? Also, things like implants or anabolic implants will work in part because it stimulates the increase in IGF-1 production. And then things like gender. Bulls have higher IGF-1 than heifers do. And finally, frame size for cattle. If we were to look at serum levels in Charolais cross steers, 700 pounds versus, say, Hereford small frame type animals, we're going to see noticeable differences in serum IGF-1. So there are a lot of factors that influence this IGF-1 molecule that we're talking about. Okay, we're going to go back to the Australian research. I'm really happy to hear that David is here because you'll help me to or correct me if I misinterpret some of the research that's been done, because they really have been the leaders in this area, starting research back I believe, in the early 90s in terms of residual feed intake, and have helped us to, you know, guide through some of the things we should be doing. So it's been very useful to see what they've accomplished. Starting in 2002, they had enough data put together to start coming up with breeding values for RFI, and they did that based on the actual phenotype measurements, where they actually measured intake, calculated RFI, and they now have sufficient data for the estimated breeding values for the Hereford and Angus breeds. And I'm sure there's other breeds that are very close to having their own, if not already. But those are the two breeds that are currently where they have EPDs available. Then, of course, in 2004, they then came up with the idea of using serum IGF-1 as an indicator trait for RFI based on research that they've been collecting over there in Australia. And so now they have the ability to calculate EPDs both based on the phenotype measurement of RFI, but then also the indicator trait for serum IGF-1. And they have a commercial company in Australia called Prime Grow that currently markets a test where cattlemen can go out, get a blood sample, submit it to Prime Grow, they can analyze it for serum IGF-1, and then that gets used for genetic evaluation of RFI. Well, why did they pick IGF-1? There's lots of hormones. There's thyroid hormones, growth hormone, insulin, leptin. But when they looked at some of the research that was out there, including some work that Mike Davis has been doing at Ohio State, they're finding that, number one, IGF-1 is heritable by itself. Okay, so it's about the same level of heritability as RFI trait. Also, work has been shown to indicate that IGF-1 is genetically correlated to growth and carcass traits in cattle, as well as related to some of the reproductive traits. Finally, serum IGF-1 has been shown to be related to efficiency, not only in cattle, but also in pigs and some of the other species. What I want to try to do now is to go through and try to summarize some of the Australian data. And this is what we had the charge to do down in Mariel earlier this year. Johnston, 2002, reported on two data sets. And the first data set involved multiple breeds, and the cattle were backgrounded after weaning and then put on feed. And it's not entirely clear, reading some of those publications, exactly, you know, the diet that was fed. But what they reported was a genetic correlation of positive 0.56 between RFI and serum IGF-1 in those cattle. In another set of cattle, Angus cattle that were put on feed earlier at 9 months, they found a correlation of 0.39. Now, these same two studies, they found serum IGF-1 was correlated genetically at a negative, around about negative 0.2. So that study in particular showed that those cattle that had lower serum IGF-1, okay, would have a lower RFI. So lower serum IGF-1 is good. Also, those cattle that had lower IGF-1 would have slightly higher growth rates. Second study, recently published by Moore, also Australia data, basically says the same thing. Genetic correlation there, 0.41, and the correlation there with growth rate, a negative 0.17. So it's on the basis of this research that really gave them the justification, the incentive to go after using IGF-1 as an indicator trait for RFI. We started doing some research as well, measuring RFI in steers. These are Bromby-sired steers, about 180 steers in that left study. The study on the right involved actually Boss Marbles, about 60 of those. And we measured serum IGF-1 at the start of the test, and these are the phenotypic correlations that we saw. The steer study, positive correlation, phenotypic correlation with serum IGF-1 and growth rate. So that's opposite of what the Australians have seen in terms of a negative correlation genetically. Okay? But we did see a positive correlation. Now, this is a low correlation, though. That green bar, 0.2 between serum IGF-1 and RFI. Again, showing those animals that had the lower serum IGF-1 had the lower, more efficient RFI. Full study, basically the same kind of thing, maybe a little bit higher level of the correlations. But what was interesting to see here is that in that bull study, correlation with growth was actually zero. So these data, my interpretation was that these two studies supported what the Australians had been finding. What I've shown here is simply taking the same data, looking at the average serum IGF-1 in the cattle that had low, medium, and high R5. We split these cattle out statistically, basically divide them into thirds based on plus or minus a half standard deviation. And so the blue bars are showing the average serum concentration of those animals that we classified as having low R5. And of course, the green bars are those animals that had the high. So you can see the magnitude of difference in actual serum levels of IGF-1. At the time that this is all starting, you know, all this IGF-1 research, Mike Davis at Ohio State had already been well into a selection experiment where he was selecting cattle based on serum IGF-1. This is before the concept that IGF-1 may be related to efficiency in R5. They did this experiment, or started this experiment, based on the knowledge that we had about serum IGF-1 being an anabolic hormone and the fact that there was evidence that it was heritable. And so Mike's idea was that if we select for high serum IGF-1, those cattle may be growing faster, plus those cattle might be putting down more lean tissue and less fat. And so he set up a divergent selection experiment to test that idea. It started in 1989. And Mike, I'm sure I'm not going to get all the details right, but I'm trying to summarize what you put into about 12 slides, into one or two slides here. But he started out with two herds, fall calving, spring calving herds. In each of those two herds, he had 50 cows for high, 50 cows for low, genetic selection for serum IGF-1. And he collected blood samples from the progeny on day 28, 42, and 56 post-weaning, yes. I want to make sure I didn't have post-calving up there. And he analyzed those blood samples sent for IGF-1, and then he would go in and he would select the top four bulls and the lower four bulls based on the actual serum IGF-1 and then use those four bulls for selection. When he had to replace females, he would also do that with the heifers. Potential heifer replacements, he would measure serum IGF-1 and then make selection pressure the same way. And so he's done that since 1989, and I believe you're at about six generations of selection for low and high serum IGF-1. Well, these are some of the genetic correlations. He's got lots and lots of genetic correlations. And I'm hoping that I've got up here the most current ones. But what they've found, you know, across both selection lines, these are the genetic correlations between serum IGF-1 and these traits. So weaning weight, for example, genetic correlation of 0.1, pretty small. So it says that weaning weight is going to get bigger, you know, if you have higher serum IGF-1. Off-test weight, genetic correlation 0.28, average daily gain 0.29. And so it's kind of supporting his original idea that if we select for higher serum IGF-1, we're going to have higher post-weaning average daily gain. Back fat thickness, a negative correlation. So if we select for increased serum IGF-1, cattle will be a little bit leaner. And quality grades, yield grades, you can see go in the same direction. Well, about probably 3 years ago, Mike and I were visiting, and I said, if you started to measure feed intake in those cattle, because of what the Australians had found and what we'd been finding, a perfect selection experiment to address the question, is serum IGF-1 going to help us as an indicator trait to select for efficient cattle? And Mike, unfortunately, didn't have feed intake equipment up there, and so we ended up for over 2 years shipping cattle from Ohio down to Texas. And when they'd come down to us, you know, in the wintertime, real long hair, which quickly got taken care of. So the cattle had to adapt for a period of time to a climate change. But after we got them adapted to our climate, adapted to our facility, adapted to the diet, We then measured residual feed intake for 70 days. And this is the data that we have from the first year. First year, we put them on a high roughage type diet, basically the same kind of diet that we were feeding on those first two studies I was showing you, the steer study and the bull study. Those were on fairly high roughage type diets, pretty similar to what this one was. I know this is a complicated graph, but I wanted to show you the numbers that we had here. We've got bulls and heifers that were selected for low and high serum IGF-1. And you can see the numbers of cattle. The high IGF-1 heifers, we had 13 of those animals first year. What the first row is showing us is that there was a difference in serum IGF-1. So by selecting for almost six generations, you know, the cattle that were selected from the low serum IGF line, in fact, had lower serum IGF levels at the start of our test. Initial body weight and average daily gain were not different. Then we look at dry matter intake. Dry matter intake was not different. Okay? So we saw no effect of selection line across both heifers and bulls in terms of growth and intake performance. Likewise, feed to gain ratio was not different. We looked at RFI. There was a tendency for there to be a significant selection line effect. We like to see that number to be down a p-value of less than 0.05 or lower to be really significant. Okay. So when we looked at the means, what we found both in the bulls and the heifers, that the low IGF line cattle had more negative RFIs compared to the high IGF-1 line cattle. Now, the magnitude of the difference there is not very large. And you got to keep that in mind. If you look at the bulls, a positive 0.7 pounds per day versus a negative 0.7 pounds per day, you know, so that's a pound and a half. So it's significant, but it's not as large a magnitude that we would have hoped to have seen. Now, we decided, okay, if we saw a difference that first year on a roughage diet, we thought, well, maybe we'll see a bigger difference if we put them on a high grain diet. So second year, we repeated the experiment, had a few more cattle this time. Again, serum IGF levels were different. But as you can see, you don't have to spend much time looking at that graph. We saw no difference in growth, no difference in performance, intake, RFI, or feed to gain ratio. Okay? So we're a little perplexed by the results, but that's the data that we have. Okay? Now, looking at the composition of the cattle, these were based on ultrasound data, and I've combined the two genders to make this table look a little easier. We have here again high versus low IGF line. You can see the numbers for study 1 and study 2. And take home message here is that even though we saw a small difference in RFI in study 1, there was no difference in composition of the cattle at the end of the experiment. The second study, again, that's the study we saw no difference in RFI because of selection line. But here we're seeing a significant difference in back fat thickness at the end of the test. And what we found is that the cattle from the low IGF-1 selection line had less back fat than the high IGF cattle. Okay, we've done another experiment. Been fortunate to be able to work with Camp Cooley folks down in Franklin, Texas. And we've measured RFI in a set of their replacement heifers for 3 years. We're getting ready to do it for a fourth year coming up. One of the projects that we're interested in with that set of cattle was to look at this relationship between serum IGF-1 and RFI in these cattle. So total now over 3 years, almost 350 head. The initial weight of these cattle coming in, 600 pounds. They're about 7.5 months of age. They're on a high roughage type diet, again, as we've used before. And we measure feed intake for 70 days. It fits the guidelines that the Australians have for using how best to use IGF-1 as an indicator trait. So a good test to see what the relationship is between serum IGF-1 and RFI. This is just a table to summarize some of the data that we've seen over 3 years. Again, what I've done here is to split those 350 animals into the low RFI efficient animals versus the high RFI inefficient animals based on that plus or minus a half standard deviation. On the low RFI set of cattle, we've got 112 heifers. The high, we've got 98. You see the average residual feed intake in pounds per day, a negative 1.7 for the lows versus 1.9 positive for the highs. You see no difference in weaning weight or initial or final weight or average daily gain of those two low versus high RFI phenotypes, as we would expect. Okay? There is, though, a big difference, again, as we would expect, in dry matter intake. Essentially, the high RFI heifers across these 3 years consume 20% more feed than the low RFI heifers, even though body weight and gain is the same. Feed-to-gain ratio, you can see 10.6 versus 8.9. Okay, what do we see in terms of the relationship with serum IGF-1? Very, bottom line, very, very disappointing. Okay, there is no correlation in this set of cattle between serum IGF-1 and RFI. Just take you through these data quick. Average daily gain, the phenotypic correlation is, we haven't done the genetic stuff yet, this is all phenotypic, but the phenotypic correlation is a negative 0.11, which is very similar to what, or it's in the same direction as what the Australians were finding before. Dry matter intake, a negative 0.07, you know, not significant. RFI, the actual correlation there, negative 0.05, not significant. Feed-to-gain ratio, 0.07, and then back fat, a positive 0.11 that was slightly significant. So the take-home message we have here with Brangus heifers is that serum IGF-1 is not correlated to RFI. Should mention that the serum sample that I'm reporting here was obtained at weaning time. So the Australians have looked at that kind of research, and they've determined the best time to measure serum IGF-1 to be a good predictor of RFI is 3 or 4 weeks prior to or at weaning time. And so that's what we did in this particular experiment, but yet we failed to see that positive relationship between serum IGF-1 and RFI. Now, the Australians have recently, I know David, you were on this paper, reported another set of cattle looking at the relationship between RFI and serum IGF-1. And I need to set this experiment up here a little bit more for you. Number one, these calves were not put into the feed yard to measure RFI right after weaning. They were first backgrounded and then put into the feed yard after, I think, maybe 6 or 8 months, thereabouts. The other thing that's different in this particular set of cattle is that they were fed on a high-grain diet, and these cattle were also implanted with CompuDose. Most of the other experiments that have been done looking at the relationship between serum IGF-1 and RFI have been in breeding stock or cattle that have not been implanted. Our experiments to date, we've not ever implanted our cattle because we're trying to look at the natural variation that exists between things like, you know, serum IGF-1 and RFI independent of the effect the implant's going to have. Administering implants will naturally increase serum IGF-1 levels, and it may mask some of the genetic variation that we see in those cattle. They had two sets of cattle. One was all Brahman, if I remember right. The other were what they call tropical composites, cattle that had around 50% either Bos Indicus or some other like Sangha breed. Okay, so two obviously Bos Indicus related type of cattle. They also sampled for IGF-1 post-weaning, I think 2 or 3 months post-weaning, but then also after the backgrounding phase before they went into finishing on high-grain diets. And the interesting thing here is that essentially the genetic correlation between those two different time points by IGF-1 and RFI for the Brahman cattle was essentially zero or close to it. Whereas if you look at the composite cattle, tropical composite cattle had about 50% Bos Taurus, the correlations were very negative, which is opposite of what they had previously reported in Angus cattle. And this is opposite of what we've seen in a couple of our smaller studies. Okay, so whereby before they were reporting a positive genetic correlation, between IGF-1 and RFI, which says you want to find those cattle that have low serum IGF-1 so that you can indirectly select for low serum or low RFI. A negative correlation says the opposite. And so it's significant, highly significant, but it's in an opposite direction. And so for us sitting around a table in Atlanta, you know, this kind of data was hard to try to get our handle, our minds around it. So it is perplexing. And we don't really have a whole lot of good explanations. I'm going to try to summarize a few thoughts about that. Okay. First, if we look at the relationship between serum IGF-1 and RFI in Boss Taurus type cattle, Angus, Hereford, Shorthorn, you know, there's not been too many breed comparison studies done. But I think it's safe to say that if we were to take a serum IGF-1 measurement at weaning time in Boss Taurus type cattle, and we measured RFI fairly early post weaning before they became yearlings, there appears to be a good positive relationship between serum IGF-1 and RFI, indicating that it might be useful as a selection indicator trait. Okay. Beyond that, though, that relationship starts to fall apart. So it appears to be inconsistent when we start looking at the variation within cattle that have Bos indicus influence, i.e. our Brangus heifer experiment. There was no significant correlation. And, of course, the data that I just presented from that Walcott paper. Also, and these next two items, it's hard to sort out, is it due to a diet effect, growing ration, versus a finishing ration, or is it just simply because if young growing cattle that are putting down more lean, less fat, versus the older cattle that are putting down more fat, less lean, what is it about the relationship between serum IGF-1 and RFI that doesn't hold up and is not consistent? You know, we don't know really, don't have the data at this point to try to tease that apart to fully understand it. Lastly, we haven't done the experiments where we can look to see if we have one set of cattle in the contemporary group that are not implanted, others are, does that change the relationship between serum IGF-1 and RFI? This data indicates the possibility. That's a question that really needs to be addressed before we can more fully advise the prospects of going after serum IGF-1 as an indicator trait. So, with all that said, we got to the end of our discussion, a few more emails, and we said we just don't feel comfortable recommending to you guys right now that you go out and start testing for serum IGF-1. And so that's the take-home message for this part of the talk. There is, though, I think, the prospect that it may result in a useful index, useful indicator trait sometime, but we need more research. And we need to look at what happens if we do select for low versus high serum IGF-1. Will it have any negative impact on reproduction or other traits like marbling? We need to sort out some of these relationships that I just went through. I won't go back through that again. You know, we need to figure out why there are inconsistencies between that relationship between IGF-1 and RFI before we can ever recommend that it be used on a more global basis. There's also the prospect for other related peptide molecules associated with IGF-1, things like binding proteins, there's IGF-1 receptors, there's other molecules that are linked to the growth hormone IGF-1 growth axes that we need to probably look at. Maybe one of those other protein molecules may help explain some of these inconsistencies, or maybe we can learn that they're better predictors of RFI than the IGF-1 molecule itself. So there, that's what we came up with. So if there's any questions? Any
questions for Gordy? How many sets of cattle were compared to come out with this in conclusion?
Well, basically what I put up here, I mean, there's more data sets. David, you've been quiet so far. Would you want to, the question was, how many data sets had there been looking at the relationship between RFI and IGF-1? You know, can you make a quick synopsis of how many sets of cattle you guys have looked at?
Angus have individual breeding types, and they have 20,000 IGFs, not on themselves, but on relatives. And then in that Brahman and composite data set, there were 2,000 Brahman and composites of those 1,500 at feed intakes, and all of them had IGF, including 2,000 systems that also had IGF. So reasonably big data set, but you can probably wonder why I cut my hair short so I don't pull my hair out with this IGF-1. I can just add quickly that the reason we understand now that the IGF correlations are changing, and you've got to be very careful looking at phenotypic versus genetic, that's the first comment. The second is RFI ain't RFI. So RFI measured in young growing bulls is not the same trait as RFI measured in fattening steers on a high-energy diet. So we reckon the correlation is at best 0.6, and that's some latest research, so I think BIF has some guidelines that they might want to address. And we also now truly believe that the relationship between IGF-1 and those two tests is quite different, if not completely explaining why the correlation is changing versus the composition of gains. So there's a lot of little messages in there, but at the moment I think for BIF to recommend not using IGF-1 is probably a sound recommendation, but certainly for your guidelines, looking at how you define RFI is going to be important because it isn't the same thing.
I'll agree with that. We've just done one study where we've looked at RFI in growing cattle and then put them on high grain and measured RFI again. Phenotypic correlation was like 0.5 to 0.6. I know Denny Cruz is not here right now, but he's measured RFI in both grain-fed cattle and roughage-fed cattle, and I think is coming up with about the same kind of correlation. It does really add a little bit of complexity, you know, to this idea of testing for RFI. You know, do we want to be feeding high roughage growing rations or finishing rations? And I don't have a good handle on that myself right now.
Do you have any kind of a handle on correlation between RFI and those growing cattle and efficiency in the cows?
Well, again, Australians have got some of that data. We don't have any ourselves yet. I know up in Alberta they're doing some of that, and the folks, again, over in Australia have done that. I want to try to summarize. About two generations, might be three generations now, selection for low versus high RFI in the heifers is what they've done. And what they did as part of that experiment is they measured RFI in the growing heifer on an alfalfa-based pelleted ration. They let those females have two sets of calves, and instead of breeding them up the next time, they kept them open. They brought them back into the same facility, measured RFI in the cows, mature cows. And they found a pretty strong phenotypic and genetic correlation between RFI in the heifer versus RFI in the cow. So that and some preliminary research coming out of Alberta does indicate that there is a pretty good relationship. It's not going to be perfect between RFI and the growing post-weaning calf and the mature cow, but there doesn't appear to be any downsides either in terms of reproductive status or poor condition, et cetera, relationship between RFI and the growing calf and that mature cow. That's an area that's going to take a little bit more time to come up with more solid data on that.